Jocks.
Starks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now.
We are live.
Lord Oak Bank, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Jimmy on the board. SP Futures down a buck. Down a buck. After another big update yesterday. As that Futures down too. Are you saying that Lou needs a brand new beat?
I approve of this kind of intro as opposed to the somewhat dated intros we've been using.
They're only 10 years old. What do you mean dated?
Well, they're older than that. I mean,
they're older than that, yeah.
I joined you guys in 2011, and
yeah,
I've been hearing the same thing. So I'm all in favor of using upbeat music. It's a good wake up.
I think it is too. I have a couple of questions for you that I don't want to drop here. One is, have you ever heard of this outfit, Dragonfly?
I know of several companies with that.
Well, it's moniker. It's Dragan Fly. Drro, I think, is it? They allegedly got some big contract for military drones, and so people were pouring into the stock. I'm not saying buy it because it's up from 3 to 11, but I have no idea how big. I guess when this stuff happens and people start buying stocks, sometimes the money's too big for the company. I have no idea how big that contract is, and evidently the Army.
Dragonfly Innovations.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're an aircraft drone manufacturing operation. There's been a huge, obviously as a result of what you're seeing in Ukraine and a few other places, there's been a huge uptick in interest in these things, the drones of all types. And just to give you a level and a picture of what has developed on the battlefront in Ukraine, which is probably the fastest evolving kind of theater where you see these things developed. You started out with drones that were doing things that we had been seeing in the Middle East, which was basically dropping hand grenades or thermite grenades or in some cases small mortar rounds, which weighed a couple of pounds. And these things would fly up. They had little releases on them. They were what are called first person view drones, where you've got an operator that's actually flying the thing and watching through a video link to target something.
Is that a direct feed? Is that a direct feed or is that a satellite?
Yes, it's a direct feed.
So it's not a satellite bump up or down.
No, that's how it started. Was direct feed. So
once you go over Horizon, You can still do that.
Depending on where you are, what you're doing. Yes, the FPVs, the FPV drones are where it's at right now in Ukraine. So it starts with this direct feed, and then it evolved. So then you started getting heavier and heavier drones, and the Ukrainians jumped ahead on this that were actually carrying artillery shells. So you'd have a drone carrying like a 155 artillery shell. And dropping that, or carrying an anti-tank round that they could drop from altitude.
If you're controlling about 20 drones, what the hell does your screen look like if you got 20 feeds?
If you look at what you see in Ukraine, you see multiple screens, and so these drones have developed from these small first-person view quadricopters that you can buy off the shelf to multi-engine, little devices that are capable of carrying, tens of and 20 pounds. They've developed into drones that are dropping, from drones that are dropping hand grenades and small charges, to drones that are carrying fairly large explosive charges that detonate, that are carried internally, that will detonate on impact or will detonate above.
These things are all still vertical takeoff and landing, though, right?
Not all of them, but yes, for the most part.
I mean, you don't need a runway for these things, or do you?
In some cases, they're launched, for the ones that have wings, they're launched off a platform.
Okay, but they can't land back there, can they, or can they?
Generally, no. If they're returnable, typically they'll land into a net or something like that.
Okay.
So they now have drones that are electronic warfare drones that carry signal jamming capability, so that they can jam the signal feed, not just from radars or from radios, but from other drones. They've got drones that attack other drones. They've got drones that are semi and fully autonomous, where you point the thing in the right direction and you launch it, and they will fly, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 miles on their own looking for targets. You've got drones that operate in extended distances and ranges that are altitudes that provide just reconnaissance, so that, you know, effectively anything within, you know, 6 to 8 miles either side of where the forces are engaged or where you've got combat going on effectively becomes a kill zone, where anything that moves gets spotted by one of these high altitude reconnaissance drones, and then they relay the information down to a ground site, and a drone is dispatched with a cannon shell or with a bomb or that'll then attack that target. The drones are, in some cases, are controlled by fiber optic cables, so that the drone itself can't be jammed or the signal interrupted.
A cable goes to the drone?
Yeah, and they go for miles.
Really?
If you
it sounds like a torpedo, right?
Yeah, and if you will come across, there's been a number of videos coming out of Ukraine where the landscape is just, it looks like something, you know, those giant spider infestations where there's web everywhere. The landscape looks like that. You know, hundreds and hundreds of these fiber optic cables, and they're very fine. They're like fishing line, stretched across fields and trees and whatever. These drones have moved in for attack.
How do you get enough guys to drive 300 drones in a year?
You have them. They can be highly effective.
Well, I'm saying, how do you get somebody to drive 300 of them up in the air at the same time?
Well, it's not necessarily one guy controlling, you know, hundreds of drones. You have an individual operators who are flying these things.
Okay.
And so, again, because of the fact that you've got a sort of an omnipresent surveillance capability, because you've got these things up in the air all the time, they can see in infrared.
If I was going to be a real knucklehead and go back to Billy Mitchell times, I learn about this through you, okay? A little bit I read, but mostly through you. I have a feeling that if we had somebody capable of getting people in a room together and say, all right, these things seem like they're getting better, like, all the time, which is pretty damn obvious, isn't it? Well, are we going to be designing ships for the future that are essentially drone ships? I thought of you the other day, Lou. I get somebody send a Quora thing at me, and they were talking about some almost like World War II looking plane with almost like stuff that shot, I'll use the term flak, was a prop, and they're saying they're thinking about something like this for drone attacks, where you could just shoot the thing off, you know, 1,000 yards ahead of you, and blow little shots in every direction and take out 30 drones or something. I mean, there's people that are thinking. I guess what I'm saying is, if we all got some people, not me, in a room to take notes, would we still be building aircraft carriers like we're building, or would we? Maybe we'd still build some, but shouldn't we be building something smaller that essentially is a drone hangout of you know, something that you could be a World War II size carrier or something, or not even a carrier? I mean, are we getting there that fast?
We are, and you saw an attack by Ukraine within a year where they had carriers, drone carriers. They were on land. They were trucks that they, you know, drove across country through Russia, parked outside various airfields.
Oh, that's right. The one in Siberia, where we are.
Exactly. And then at the proper time, the roofs opened and, you know, 100 drones flew out, or 60 drones flew out. So the key to drone use is the fact that they're cheap, and relatively cheap,
they're getting more and more capable. So they're going to be getting more and more expensive the more you ask them to do.
Well, okay, so I'm looking at your Dragonfly website right now. I'm looking at their product line. So
By the way, DPRO is the symbol, not
okay.
PRRO.
So you've got a drone that has a 6.6 pound payload and flies maybe 6 miles. It's got a flight time of 45 minutes, and its starting price is $16,000.
As
You
opposed to a
got
million-dollar missile.
you've got you've got another one that carries 22 pounds with a flight time of 50 minutes, and its starting price is $23,000. And then you've got what they call a heavy lift drone.
Okay, what is something 23 pounds get you in terms of boom?
Well, 23 pounds of explosive or 23 pounds of electronics can get you a fairly robust effect if you want to blow up a room.
Now, does this thing drop it on somebody, or does the thing go at them like a kamikaze?
It can go either way. It can drop it, or it can be a kamikaze drone, or it can, as I said, be a surveillance or electronic warfare, or it can carry some kind of light rifle or gun that will fire.
Well, if it drops it, are we talking 10,000 feet, 2,000 feet, or 10 feet?
It's a question of you can drop. I don't know what the operational ceiling is on something like that, but you can drop it from whatever height you want, as high as the drone can get. It's just a
And
question of, can you target it?
yeah, I'm saying, and how are you going to
So,
target it though, without without knowing the wind and all the other
then you put a smart munition on the drone
All right.
that you carry it up to altitude, you fly along, you see your target, and the operators tells the smart munition, okay, that's the thing I want you to hit. Go. And the smart munition flies away. We've had capability like that for some time. And then a heavy lift drone, which can carry 66 pounds, flight time of 55 minutes, and
Well,
it
how
starts
big
at
is that thing?
$55,000. It's big. 125 inches long by 125 inches wide by 30 inches high. So you're talking about something that's,
But
the size of.
it's still a helicopter drone. It's not a wing drone.
No, it's a helicopter drone.
Right.
So, these things are the tremendous advantage of these things is that they're cheap, and that you can make a lot of them, and that they can be launched or deployed en masse, so that whatever defense system you've got is overwhelmed, and can't handle.
An F-35 is useless against them.
Well, no, you wouldn't shoot. You wouldn't use an F-30. The only time you would use an F-35 to shoot down something like that is if you were attacking something that was moving high enough and fast enough so that the F-35 could target it. Something, I mean, theoretically, you could shoot down a stationary object with an F-35 if it's big enough. But bottom line is these things are not the kind of devices that these quadricopters or hovering drones are not the kinds of things you're going to be shooting down with an aircraft. The longer range drones, the autonomous targeting ones that you basically give it a GPS, a set of GPS coordinates, and launch it, and 6 hours later it gets to the target and blows up, or gets to the coordinates and blows up whatever's there. It's, those things are capable of being shot down by aircraft, and those are targeted when Iran launched
But by a
its
gun or by a
attack.
missile or by a
By
shack of
both, by both. When Iran launched its attack against Israel, a number of the drones that it fired were taken down by aircraft. Um,
It seemed to
but
me you'd
but
want some kind of a cannon that blew up like shrapnel almost rather than a
well,
missile.
that's and that's one variation of drone defense. The initial move on the stuff to defend against this stuff were our traditional systems of missiles, which are very quickly become saturated. You can't fire enough missiles, you can't fire them fast enough to an attack on a target, a high value target, might involve 100 drones. Nobody has a stockpile of 100 missiles sitting around that could be fired once those things are detected. So the move then went from there to guns and some kind of gun system, and there are a number of those things that are still being fielded that put out airbursts because the drones themselves, again, because they're cheap and because you can make lots of them, they're not robust. I mean, you can hit them with a relatively, you know, indirect blast from a fragmentation warhead.
What are they powered by? They're electric?
They're electric, yeah. Right. The short range ones that you're talking, you and I are talking about are electric. Some of the other ones have, you know, have turbine motors on them. Some are jet powered. But the quadricopter stuff that we're talking about, the vertical takeoff, the first person drones, these things are for the most part electric. So you go from missile to gunshot fragmentation warheads. The Israelis have developed, and I think we are looking at deploying, lasers that can burn through the rotors or the control surfaces on the drone and take it down. And that can theoretically, if you get a high enough powered laser, can take down multiple targets in an engagement. It can do it quickly. And then
right now, if somebody fires 100 drones at you, you're pretty screwed. Somebody's getting screwed.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, if they get to the target, yeah, you're in trouble. Other alternative means of defending against them: netting. I mean, if you can put netting up, that will for the most part stop most of the kamikaze drones, the first person attack drones. They can't. You know, they're not sophisticated enough, and they can't carry a big enough warhead to damage something far enough away that netting is not effective, and you see this in place all over Ukraine. Electronic warfare systems that can jam the drone's data link, interrupt its visual feed, so the operator loses control of it. That's highly effective. All of this is developing very, very rapidly. And then, you know, you put those systems on other drones, Chief, so that the drone itself, you have a drone that flies out and takes up a stationary position, you know, 2-3 miles from your place. And when the opposing drones are coming in, that drone has a capability to detect them, identify them, and then either target them itself or use, you know, direct other systems to target it.
Seems like if you send 100 drones at somebody, 9 of them could have nothing on them, or 90 of them could have nothing on them, and the chances of the people shooting down the 10 that are dangerous are pretty slim.
That's one tactic. So the Ukrainians have really done this very effectively. There was a fairly massive attack on a Russian air defense system in Crimea that took place about within the last 6 months. And it involved the launching of a number of decoy drones that had radar reflectors on them, so they sort of looked like aircraft. And they were one way, not really necessarily just targeting or aimed at the specific radar site that they were, or air defense site they were trying to take down, but just fired in the general vicinity so that the air defense radar would pick them up and they would start trying to target them. In the meantime, the actual explosive drones, and there were like 30 or 40 of them, were coming in low and much slower, but they were coming in from all directions. So, you know, you if your air defense radar is all looking in one direction, looking at these things that they think are aircraft, in the meantime, you've got a number of drones coming in from, you know, 180 degrees in the opposite direction and other vectors that are all approaching the same target, and it basically makes an impossible targeting situation for a traditional air defense kind of system. And again, you know, they don't have to get, you're not talking about having to drop a 200 pound or 300 pound bomb on these things, because the drones can go right up to whatever the target is. A relatively small charge is as good as a 500 pound bomb. You can disable the system, take it offline, destroy radar antennas, destroy the missiles, blow up the missiles with a hand grenade.
So a 20-pound one of these explosives does some work.
Well, yeah, especially if it's got fragmentation on it.
Ugh.
So the upshot of this is that you know, instead of needing artillery pieces that can fire 20 miles and have to saturate an area with artillery fire to hit your target, you launch 20 or 30 of these drones, and they go out and fly out, and you're almost guaranteed target destruction. without having to saturate an area with, you know, hundreds of rounds of artillery fire to make sure you killed what you wanted.
Hey, I wanted to ask you real quick.
Short answer.
Right.
To a certain extent, we're playing catch up right now because this stuff was not glamorous, but it's highly effective. And we're
catching up to who? Who's the leader in this?
China.
Okay.
And Russia, to a lesser extent, although the Russians buy most of their parts through China. But yeah, China. I mean, I have a Chinese manufactured drone in my house.
Really?
They basically cornered the market.
What, you buzz the neighbors?
No, I fly it. I can't fly it around here in the neighborhood. I have to go out to Colorado has a number of regulations about.
So you're not checking out what people are wearing near their backyard pools or anything.
I mean, theoretically, I guess I could. It's very small and it's pretty quiet, but no, I don't fly it in the neighborhood. That's
Audrey hires a guy that does some drone photographs for people, and you can't be over Main Street for fear the thing might drop on somebody's car. There's a lot of restrictions.
Oh yeah, no, they're it's very restricted. But yeah, you fly in the backyard, take it up into the national forest, and you can fly it all over the place.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about this guy. I'm sure you know everything, it seems. We'll zip on to whatever. This guy, why does this guy intrigue me so much? Well, because he should, I suppose. This guy, George Hardy, the Tuskegee Airmen guy, the last one died at 100 a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you read this story. He was 19 when he enlisted, 43 or 4 or whatever. And, well, like I said, a dude died, he's 100 years old. Good-looking guy. This guy, a picture of him, like, he's 90, looks pretty good. The dude flew, like, 19 or 20 missions in World War II, like 45 in Korea, and like 75 in Nam. How many people flew in World War II and flew in Nam? There can't be very many.
Oh, there were hundreds.
Really, 20 years later?
Oh, yeah.
25 years later?
Oh, yeah. So
boy, why did I not know that?
One of my all-time favorite characters in military aviation is a guy named Robin Olds. He's passed away now, but he was if I'm getting this right, he was a World War II. He flew in World War II, and then by the time he got to Vietnam, he had a couple of kills in Korea, and then by the time he got to Vietnam, he was a colonel. And just an absolute hellraiser, and very, very competent in terms of fighter tactics. He basically organized what was called a MiG sweep, where his guys shot down like 7 or 8 North Korean or North Vietnamese MiGs in one mission. Basically lured the North Vietnamese into thinking that a bunch of aircraft on the radar were bombers going in for a bombing mission, and in fact they were F-4s loaded with air-to-air ordnance, and when the MiGs came up, the F-4s uncovered and then shot a bunch of them down. Absolute hellraiser, absolute iconoclast, nonconformist. He was promoted to Brigadier General and made Commandant of Cadets at the Air Force Academy because, according to legend, the Air Force, he had 4 kills in Vietnam. The Air Force did not want to make him an ace because he was such a nonconformist and he'd irritated so many higher-ups.
Good for him.
with his actions. So they made him Commandant of Cadets, which again proves that the Air Force doesn't understand why it has an Air Force Academy. They looked at the Academy as a place to park this guy to get him out of the way, instead of doing what they should have, which is we got a warrior here, we got a soldier, let's get him in front of the cadets so they can see what it's supposed to look like. But he was a fascinating character. My favorite
was he was he there when you were there?
No, I just missed him. The stories about him when I got there were legion. My favorite one is he was driving in his staff car across the the what's called the terrazzo, the area where the it's sort of like a quad, a big open area where the cadets go back and forth to the classes. And it was cold, so the cadets had their parkas on. And he's driving along, and he looks out the window of his car, and there's this cadet walking along with his parka, and he's got the hoods were up on these parkas, but this guy had a bright orange ski cap on instead of the black watch cap that was mandatory with the uniform. So this guy's got this bright orange thing on under his parka, which of course just a straight up deliberate uniform violation. So Olds, not being somebody who's gonna let something like this go by, jumps out of the car and yells, "You," points at this kid, "You get over here." And the cadet sees him and runs and turns around and runs away. and it was during class change, like shift change. So there's literally hundreds of cadets out in this area walking
all
around.
All wearing the same hat except one kid.
All except this one kid. So the kid turns around and runs, and Olds chases him. And they go running through the air gardens in this area around the academic building. Of course, all the cadets are stopping and saluting, "Good morning, sir. Good morning, sir." And Olds goes, "Get out of the way." He's chasing this kid. And the guy runs into the academic building, takes the hat off, and there's like hundreds of cadets milling around in the stairwells and in the alcoves in this academic building. The kid runs into the academic building, takes the hat off, and immediately becomes invisible because there's hundreds of these guys walking around, and they're all dressed the same. And so Olds loses him. So at the noon meal that day, they have announcements, and the cadet's going through the announcements, and the last announcement is, "Will the cadet who was chased by General Olds through the air garden report to his office at 1300 today?"
Did he?
And of course, the wing, there's 4,400 guys in this dining hall. They're all there at the same time. This announcement gets made, and they all, the wing cheers. They all cheer. Hey, So the kid reports as ordered to Olds' office and salutes and says, "Sir, I'm the guy.
I'm guilty. I'm guilty.
I'm the guy." And Olds just, I guess, gave him a very brief, just said, the first thing Olds said to him was, "Took a lot of guts for you to show up here, and I appreciate the fact that you came in here," and then just ripped into him, ending with something like, "When a general officer tells you to do something, you do it, you don't pull some stupid stunt like that." He did not write him up. He didn't give him punishments. He didn't make him, march tours or any of the other stuff. He yelled at him, told him, first of all, "I appreciate you showing up. That took a lot of guts." Olds immediately respected that, and then just ripped into him. But the idea of a one-star general, in uniform, shoes shined, uniform immaculate, chasing some cadet through the academy terrain is just about the funniest thing I've heard of. Anyway, that's old. So yes, there were lots of guys like that.
Well, I didn't. This guy, he enlisted at age 18 in 1943, and started flying. He went to pilot school in 1944, and he was in somewhere in here. 21 missions across Europe, the youngest red tail fighter pilot with the Tuskegee Airmen, the first black aviators. Blah blah blah. But then he went to Korea. I just never thought anybody from World War II made it to Vietnam, but evidently,
there were hundreds. I mean, Chuck Yeager did the same.
He flew in.
Yeager flew in Vietnam.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so, I mean, can you tell me if I don't know this gentleman? I don't know this gentleman's biography individually. We learned of the Tuskegee Airmen at the Academy, of course. Was he on active duty the whole time? Yeah, a lot of those guys.
I think he must have. Obviously, for those that, one of the nasty things about our history is, obviously, the black soldiers were covered by the GI Bill, the males. But he was from Philadelphia. He actually went to NYU after the war and got a degree. So, but down south, I mean, you couldn't get into Alabama because you were black,
yeah.
Right? I mean,
probably recalled to active duty for Korea.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. But then,
he was a civilian, and then was redrafted into Korea.
But they didn't redraft Korean guys for Nam. You had to go volunteer again, or what?
I know. I suspect he, like a lot of guys, went back in. And flew in Korea, and then realized, you know, hey, this is not a bad life, it stayed on active duty, and then rose through the ranks. Does it say what he retired as?
Yeah, I think so, somewhere in here. Distinguished Service Cross, a Commendation Medal with one Oak Leaf Cluster, another thing with 11 Oak Leaf Clusters. Let me see. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that doesn't say what his rank was.
No, he came in as a first lieutenant, and I don't know. I'll find it here somewhere.
He probably. I'm guessing he retired.
Colonel.
Yeah, Colonel Osex. Right, Colonel. So, yeah. I mean, he stayed in for the long haul.
Well, 1944 to 1971 is a lot of flying.
Yep. And does it say what aircraft he flew?
No, it's not that detailed. But he must have been how many different kinds along the way.
Well, I mean, those guys were P-51s, Mustangs, if I remember right, in from their unit history, and then so Korea probably, you know, F-86s. He would have. I mean, we started with P-51s in Korea, probably moved on to F-86s, and then transitioned into F-105s or F-4s when he was flying it, or F-100s, F-105s, F-4s in Vietnam. So
I'm just happy the guy was from the north and actually got to use his GI Bill stuff. How come none of that was ever? Well, I guess I know.
Well, so Armed Forces officially integrated in, I believe, 47 by executive order with Truman. I mean, fully integrated. You know, they just. You know, waved the wand and said, "Okay, the black units that we had here are disbanded, and we're integrating everybody into the force." So that
did they have black infantry units as well?
I don't recall there being. You know, I mean, most of the African American units that you saw that were only African American units that you saw were support units, but I don't remember.
We sent some Japanese served in Europe.
We had Nisei, the Nisei battalions, yeah, that fought in Italy. That fought in Europe. I don't remember if we had black only infantry units. I'm sorry, I don't know that. I probably should, but
we had Japanese people who fought in Europe too, didn't we, or not?
Yeah, that's the Nisei Battalion.
Okay,
Nisei battalions. They fought in Italy. Highly decorated.
Was that whole Italy thing? Should that just have never happened? Seemed like it was a kind of a waste, wasn't it?
I don't know when you say it should never have happened.
Well, I mean, there were some people who didn't want that invasion at all. So we should.
It was designed to tie down German units that would normally have been moved to into the heart of Europe, and we wanted to try to keep the Germans occupied on as many fronts as possible, so that they couldn't deploy more units to derail the D-Day invasion and the breakout. So I mean, that's what it was designed to do. It was some of the worst fighting of the war in terms of casualties and in terms of just.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, at the end of the day, you wonder if it was even worth it.
Tiny gains made over the course of days of fighting.
Yeah, it didn't start out where we were kicking ass, and all of a sudden it just stopped. I don't think we did a very good job looking at the geography, did we?
Well, we weren't really prepared for the kind of. You know, terrain fighting, and that the Germans excelled at. I mean, there was some very competent German leadership in the field there in Italy, and we ran up against a well entrenched, well defended area with and basically the only way we could you could take the ground was to order your people forward until they either fell apart, which happened in a couple of units, or we overwhelmed the people there. So again, the idea was not necessarily to take territory, although they wanted to. They were moving in that direction, but mainly to tie down those German units so that the invasion would move forward, and the, you know, the breakout going at Germany was less hindered, if I can use that term.
I had to talk about this the other day, so I don't want to go through it totally again, but I had a chance to talk to Diane Kelly, who I think might be coming on Monday, and she's really tied up with these veteran homes, and was talking about the transition from kind of no World War II guys left to not a whole lot of Korean guys left, and every war since then has had its own set of problems, and the Vietnam stuff seems a real lot of it cancerous, which we talked about last week, which is the Afghanistan. It has all their things, and some of those they're not sure. In Gulf One, they're not sure what all those problems are. But you said the incidence of mental issues seems to be growing in all these last few wars. She doesn't know if it's from... Nobody knows where it's coming from. I said, well, could it be the vaccines? And she said, well, nobody seems to know. There's a few people who think that. I said, but the veterans' homes are really not set up right now. A couple of them are. Actually, Maywood is. Really don't have a whole lot of counselors. And the job seems to be changing a little bit. Plus, the one up in, I think I told you, the one up in Great Lakes now, they just opened one of the Fisher houses. It's kind of the only one in the country. It's sort of designed for veterans and for anybody who gets hurt at the basic training up there or anything else. So they also are housing active duty people that get hurt or, you know, lose a limb or something there, which most of them sort of aren't. There's the veterans and then there's the military hospitals, and they're kind of a dual thing up in, but she goes, they're constantly trying to, you know, see what they're going to anticipate, you know, 20 years from now. Do they need that many homes? I said, Diane, unfortunately, we always manage to find a war. I would nice to say 20 years from now you won't need all these veterans homes, but I don't know if that's the case. But anyway, she says, yeah, the mission kind of keeps changing or modifying a little bit. She goes, maybe they just didn't address all the mental issues or something, but there's a lot of autoimmune problems now and those kinds of things that they never had before. A lot of stuff you've talked about, essentially.
Well, yeah, I can't speak to causes.
She couldn't either. She said somehow or another, yeah, we have the issues are changing.
My personal opinion is that a lot of the mental issues are, or psychiatric issues are, being identified now versus not being identified previously, and I mean, some of these things create their own, you know, create their own patient base with, you know, the kinds of counseling and things like that we do. But I think what you're seeing right now is just a better understanding of the psychiatric and psychological exposures that our people have to deal with in combat, and that we are more aware of it, and that this increased awareness means we diagnose it more frequently. I don't know, it's unimaginable to me how many, you know, million guys came back from World War II with trauma, psychological trauma, that they just basically swallowed and
they drank.
Put in a box somewhere
drank.
Yeah, they drank or whatever. But
there was enough of them around. You had the rise of the VFWs, you had those kinds of things, you had these kind of groups where guys at least talked about it among themselves, even though the rest of my mother knew all about it. She says, yeah, there was battle fatigue all over the place.
Yeah. Oh yeah. But I mean it wasn't formally recognized as a, you know, the widespread phenomena that it was. You had the individual situations where guys basically became non-functional. But as a culture, we didn't really set out to say, okay, this is an issue. All these guys got exposed to this stuff. What do we, you know, what do we do? How do we deal with it?
You have to read. I mean, I'm not a big. I don't dig into the details of actors and actresses, right? But I somehow out of this Korra thing, I had no idea that Jimmy Stewart was seriously impacted by
Stewart. Stewart was heavily affected by it.
Didn't they bomb the wrong town or something?
I
think that's what happened. They bombed the wrong town. They were supposed to supposed to be hitting a ball bearing plant and they hit the wrong town, or they didn't have any kind of plant or something?
That wouldn't surprise me a bit. And yeah, I mean, if you thought about what you were doing, I mean, one of my classmates wrote a book about a P-47. You know, a P-47 is a big, heavy fighter that was operating operated all throughout Europe. I don't think they had too many of them in the Pacific, but mostly a European fighter. And you know, he talked about some of the and those guys were coming in low, you know, 20, 30 feet off the ground with 50 caliber machine guns and cannon, you know, tearing up trucks and troop convoys and you know, vehicles and anything else they could find and ground attack. And he said, you know, those guys would come back with, you know, bits and pieces of bodies, you know, all over the aircraft, because they would tear, these things would be flying along and they'd fire into like a truck loaded with soldiers. Oh. And those bullets would just tear people apart, and that they'd be explosions and things like that. And you know, he talked about one of his guys who came back with blood, you know, all over his canopy.
Well,
just covered with it. And so, you know, you go through that a couple of times, and it's traumatic. It's horrible. And so, you know, that those guys had to live with that.
Well, there was an undercurrent. I used to watch that NCIS one years ago, and there was an undercurrent in there all the time when Jethro Gibbs' father was still alive. And they were always kind of at each other's throats, typical. But the old man evidently was a fighter or a pilot. He was a bomber or what he was. But he had a couple of his buddies, one black guy and another guy, that when they came back really couldn't. They were having trouble. They drank too much. They lived with him, you know, until the wife kind of kicked him out because he really had nowhere else to live. And eventually, you know, things got better or whatever. And the kid, the star of the show, was a sniper, and you know, had a bunch of kills, I guess, doing that. And so. One day, the old man is all messed up, and the kid says, "What happened?" And he found out what happened. Evidently, somebody came in the store to rob the store, and he was giving them the money, but then they attacked some girl in the store, and he pulled out the shotgun, and he shot the guy. So the kid says to him, "Dad, what are you so bent out of shape for? I mean, you obviously killed a lot of people in the war." And he goes, "I was in a plane. I never saw him. There's a big difference."
Yeah.
I mean, I...
Well, and yet... the casualty rates for the Army Air Corps in Europe were as high, if not higher, than in terms of percentages, especially than the ground combat units.
Well, plus, how many guys died in training? More than died in the war.
Well, I mean, I'm just talking about combat deaths. Yeah. And it was an unbelievably dangerous thing, and they saw plenty. I mean, you're killing people from above, but if you read some of the accounts of what happened inside those airplanes when they were attacked, when guys got hit by gunfire or, you know, a flak and tearing people apart on the inside of the airplanes.
Oh, just watch 12 o'clock high. You see it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, or you know, the guys in the ball turrets, you know, were torn apart by, you know, cannon shells. They saw there was plenty of blood and gore and awful stuff that was going on up there as well.
We don't have that much time. Without going into the crazy politics of what's going on now, do you think, what is your feel, just in general, 2, 3, 4 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, are we going to get our act back together in this country somehow where everybody's just not fighting and troops all over the damn place and crazy stuff? I mean, are we going to figure this out? Is this just a bump along the road where we, you know, like a midlife crisis sort of a thing, that we come back being ourselves, or are we going to end up screwed up here?
I mean, the pessimistic view is that what we are seeing play out in our streets right now is the result of decades of an educational system that basically focused on a kind of anti-Americanism. It was anti-American exceptionalism, and the people that are doing the teaching are products of universities and educational programs that specifically aimed at targeting the United States as a bad nation, and because of its power and because of its influence, and that this is the result, the culmination of decades of quote-unquote indoctrination in the school system, so that we end up with a cohort of young people and people coming up into our culture who are not, do not believe that that America is the, you know, the shining city on a hill for the rest of the world. And so when things happen, or when bad stuff happens, these folks don't turn to try to fix the system. They simply criticize it.
Well, how do you mesh that
the
up?
The impact, I just want to say, one more point. The impact of unfettered immigration, coming, you know, just opening the borders up over the last, you know, 10 years has, and mainly the last 5 years, has set up a situation where the only response that is going to be workable, if you want to correct that problem, is the kind of heavy-handed response that you see now.
Well, and, I'm going to say I don't agree with that at all, but let's not fight about it. How does the economic piece land? I mean, I've been reading some articles lately where people are saying the underlying cause of all of this stuff is economic, where people are willing to believe sort of any crap that somebody's going to feed them, because they don't realize our drive towards being a plutocracy is well on its way, where it's going to be a bunch of rich people owning everything, newspapers, you name it, and whatever. And people don't even know kind of why they're pissed. I was talking to a guy the other night, actually a friend of Jimmy's, and he was talking about he's worked for this place for, I don't know, I'm going to say 12 years. I'll take a stab. And he was telling me that he started his first year, he was like 60 grand or something. Now here it is, even with our sucky CPI, he should be at 85. And he's telling me he's like 68. And we, you know, and we're getting this story from people that, oh, it's the immigrants that are stealing your paycheck because they're here and you're, you know, that's not it at all. I think people are economically challenged, economically hurt. Whenever that happens, and clearly it's not the same as, you know, living in the streets in Berlin in 1925, but when you feel that the whole rest of the world is somehow or another, you're not keeping pace, and you actually care about your family and other people, and all of a sudden you can't even guarantee any kind of a, I won't say, you know, I think you got food on the table, so it's not like the Depression or anything, but it's been a long time going, and people are willing to believe just about any crap that throws the blame on other people, and I think there are other people to blame. I don't think it's the people we're blaming. It's just me.
I've read a number of accounts. One of my favorites is Scott Adams, who said that the greatest enemy of America right now is teachers unions, because we've ended up with what I think is a poorly educated citizenry with respect to basic civic understanding, in terms of understanding how government works and what our responsibilities as citizens are. And that, you know, we have ended up with a substantial cohort in our colleges and our high schools that is unprepared for the kind of world that, you know, has developed with respect to technology and, you know, interactions in a global market. I was talking to somebody the other day, one of our associates who's, you know, old enough now to be one of my kids, or not, is actually too young to be one of my kids. And I, you know, he was kind of lamenting, you know, it's kind of a bad circumstance. And I said, look, I want you to think back, because you don't have experience with this, but I want you to go back and look up what was going on in the country in 1968. In terms of assassinations,
if you weren't there, you can't feel it, Lou.
In terms of bombs, in terms of civil unrest, in terms of war deaths, and just go back and think about that, because this is not the worst, okay? And I think we will recover from this. I think our political system tends to be self-correcting. And I think you're seeing the pendulum swinging back in the another direction to deal with whatever it is we've created for ourselves. The biggest issue that I've got is that or biggest fear that I've got is that we are going to, you know, I've talked about this before. The best laid plans of our leadership can never account for what some foreign actor decides it's going to do and the right time to do it. And this is something that we need. I mean, you see the pivot to China. If there are scenarios right now, war game scenarios right now with China, that if they decide they want to go, you know, all out short of nuclear stuff, that could cripple us very, very quickly and create issues for us that we would have to reorient our entire polity to fix. I'm hopeful that we could do it. I think we could, but we need to understand that no matter what we have going on internally, there are foreign actors that get a vote that are very powerful and that get a vote and that can dash all of that in an instant. And so, you know, I hearken back, I think it was John Kennedy's, I hate quoting him, but his comment to his brother that, you know, if we screw up domestic policy, we lose the election. If we screw up foreign policy, we die. And that's, you know, that's the thing that bothers me.
How do you?
We've got Russia. I expect the Russians to get much more aggressive over the next 6 months, because they are in a very dangerous place right now for them. And but what we're doing with Ukraine and is pushing Russia into a corner with its domestic politics. And I'm all in favor of that. I think that has to happen. But you know, the Russians are not infallible. They make miscalculations, and I'm pretty sure that's another flashpoint. You would think that war has stalemated, and it has, but it's creating real problems for Russia right now, and the way we know that is them engaging in these kind of provocative acts over Poland and Estonia and places like that.
I'm not into the somehow or another, Lou. I'm kind of just the guy sort of you're talking about, in the sense that I hope. I mean, there might be somebody who loves this country more than me. I don't know how they could love it much more, but the warts we've accumulated, you almost have to really try to love the place in a lot of ways. I mean, looking last week when I found out about the law trying to kick the Japanese out of here after they built the railroads. I mean, we've been kind of pretty awful in a lot of ways a long time. I mean, in my lifetime, I mean, the face of Robert McNamara telling people how well we're doing in Vietnam because of body counts, and you know, Colin Powell telling them about the weapons of mass destruction in Afghanistan. How many years was that? What a fiasco that was. It's really pretty hard.
And yet everybody wants to live here.
Well, I get that part. I just said it. But the point being is the idea of somebody my age looking at your leadership and saying, I believe these people, especially who we have now. God, Luke, people just don't believe it. I mean, we don't exactly look like the... We should be the bell of the ball, and I think we can be again. But you're right. There's an awful lot of people who just everybody in Washington it disgusts them. There's look at the stuff we've done with the you know, we have some Catholic priests that have had some problems. The entire religion, the entire sense of community, the entire everything. People want no part. I mean, people are weird now, and I mean I don't know. Maybe it's because of nobody gets together in groups. Whatever it is, but I think for us to get and economically, it's exactly obvious what's happening. It's exactly opposite. I mean, and you know, we've got a guy in the White House that loves it. The more money you can take, the more rich people can get. The more, I mean, he's one of the people. I mean,
I'm just gonna say that we have just survived the greatest constitutional crisis of the last 120 years.
Which is what?
January 6th. We had an unelected cabal running the government.
We had a president who was going downhill mentally, and other people took charge. This guy's been there 8 months. Have you listened to him lately?
Yeah, I have, and I mean, he sounds pretty much the way he's always sounded.
Whatever. Let's not get into that.
I'm not going to buy. If you're saying
3 years from now, he's not going to be worse than. I hope he isn't, but good Lord, well, he started out almost
years,
as bad.
3 years. 3 years from now, he is going to be worse because that's how age works at that level. But the question is whether he's going to be ineffective. I don't think so.
I think you listen right to him now. He's whatever.
Well, you know,
Lou, I just listened to a thing the other day where he's talking about his uncle at MIT was the Unabomber's teacher. The Unabomber didn't go to MIT, and the uncle died 11 years before he even knew who the Unabomber was.
I thought the Unabomber did go to MIT.
No, he didn't. MIT. He went to Harvard. But his uncle died 11 years before anybody knew who the Unabomber was.
Okay, well, in any event, my point is, we had an unelected government. We had a chief executive that was mentally.
You had a Ronald Reagan situation that was worse.
No, it wasn't. For years, and this was hidden from the American public, and so I consider that to be the greatest constitutional crisis.
Do you think that the second somebody notices Trump is unfit for the job, you're going to know about it?
Yeah, I do.
Oh God, no.
I do
because your belief in these guys is I don't know why you got it, but
because unlike Biden, Trump is subject to legitimate scrutiny from the press. Biden was protected by the mainstream
legitimate
press.
Legitimate scrutiny. He won't let anybody who anyway. I don't know what causes people that are on the Democratic side to look at the disgusting stuff over there and see nothing but rose-colored stuff. I see nobody on the Republican side that looks at what's going on now and sees nothing but rose. I don't get it.
No,
I couldn't stand either one of them. But
you're attributing to me something that's not there. I am not a fan of everything this administration is doing, and I'm not a fan. You know, I Donald Trump, as I've said many times, reminds me of my worst clients. But the alternative proved itself to be totally untenable, in my opinion. And I mean, I've talked about what I think of the showstoppers for the previous administration, and there were a lot of them. I haven't had a showstopper here yet. Although
look at Chicago. Anyway,
I am watching what's going on in Chicago.
Well,
very carefully, and I'm watching what's going on in L.A. and I'm watching what's going on in Portland, and I don't like it, but I also understand why it's happening. And again, the blame, I don't blame, you know, you're elected to solve that problem. This is the way you solve the problem.
You were not elected
to enforce the law.
You were not elected to round people up at Home Depot just because they're Hispanic. If you find out that they are citizens, you let them go 4 hours later. It's not what anybody voted for this guy to do. Maybe somebody did, but I think
a lot of people voted.
Well, a lot of people
that.
Are racist. There's no question about that, Lou.
As long as
you're Hispanic, it's okay. And whatever, I know you don't think that way, but anyway, any more snow or is it all just melted?
Oh no, there's no snow up there now. It'll get here.
Are you going to try and sell the city to the mining company?
No, I think Cripple Creek is going to be intact for a while. So
all right, they still going through the entrails and pulling out more gold.
God,
$4,000 an ounce.
Listen, the price of gold is going to keep that mine operating for decades.
They
got
to be going crazy over it. How much money are they making a month?
Well, 5 years ago, no, 8 years ago, when I moved out here, they were pulling $60 million a month in clear profit. That's above and beyond.
And where was gold? $1,800?
Something else. Pardon me?
Gold was $1,800 or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Wow,
you know, and so I mean I'm sure it's 10 times that.
Why didn't we buy into that joint when you first came on the show?
Really?
Good Lord, you wouldn't have to be lawyering. I wouldn't have to be managing.
Yeah, your old advertisement said you've never been a gold bug, and maybe you should have been.
Well, you know what I have mentioned this week, I have a lot of gold positions for people, and we've had this incredible last few weeks. But unlike others that will take credit of everything, most of the people that I have. In the gold stuff, we're in there because every person that I get, I look at all their stuff, and we talk, and a lot of people have like a whole bunch of money in the queues and such, and those kinds of things in their 401ks. So they already were up to their eyeballs in stocks, and they wanted, and they said, well, what can we do something different? Well, either we would find like an index where they weren't in, or I said, you know, a little bit in the metals, 5-10%, this is back when they were cheap, probably isn't a bad idea with what these guys are doing to the dollar. When I say these guys are people in government who are favoring themselves, not just get him for the last 20 years, that somewhere along the line, these, if they keep doing this to the dollar, these metals are going to go up. But I never said sell all your stocks and buy gold. I mean, I could say that if I was one of the idiots on TV, but I'm not. It just so happened that I have a bunch of clients that had other stuff, other places, that my biggest position actually is in the metals. And so we've had this spectacular year, but I'm not gonna take credit for it and say, oh boy, I knew gold was gonna go from 2,000 to 4,000. I thought it might over a period of time if we kept doing this for the dollar. I didn't think it was gonna do it every day. So well, it just so happened that we ended up doing fine, because this was like a complimentary thing to where people had other places. But it's worked out great.
I mean, go back to what I said about foreign actors, and think about what that means for your gold prices.
Yeah, well, without a doubt. S&P futures down 1. NASDAQ futures down 14. Lou, thank you, Jimmy. We got our other guys in line.
Yes, we do.
And we got the both of them this week. Wayne and Andy.
Yes, I'm here after my medical appointment last week.
And I'm surprised that you didn't have like some agents outside watching you go in there.
Yeah. Well, I go to a VA for stuff like that. It was a CRT scan, but I can say with the government shutdown, it was eerily quiet at the VA where I go, because a lot of their admin people, weren't there. So that left them with their bare-bone essential people who were actually running equipment and doing things like that.
Is that like a real, is it just a VA facility, or is it a big hospital, regional hospital, or what is it?
Well, I go to here in Tampa, we have a very large hospital that's actually connected to two other hospitals, even by an over-the-highway causeway, or Walker's Bridge, and Moffitt, which is a big cancer center, and Florida Hospital Center. The VA started getting much, much better under Joe Biden, because he put a lot of money into it, and they started sharing doctors with well-known private entities. So things were great. They're not so great now because of what Elon Musk has done to the VA. It was really sad. Under Biden, I used to say to people who were veterans but never signed up to get their VA benefit, I said, you got to go. It's the VA is not what you saw in the movie Born on the 4th of July, where it looked terrible. It was terrible after Vietnam, during and after Vietnam, but it really improved. Now it's back, heading back to where it was. And
does that particular hospital have like a specialty? When I say that, my friend Di, who will be on Monday, yes, says the one in San Antonio is like the national burn thing, and the one here is big on prosthetics and cancer. Is that a specialty of that one?
Yeah, same thing here with the VA hospital. Its specialty is, yes, prosthetics, and also a traumatic brain and neurological injuries, from spinal
really?
Injuries,
okay,
things like that. Yeah, that's probably what it's most well known for. Yeah,
because like every one of the big ones has, I guess, some sort of a specialty. Where
yeah.
Also, you're in and out, and you're not looking behind you for guys with masks and guns, are you?
No, but here in Florida, we've already had that happen long before Trump even was reelected the second time. Ron DeSantis had been doing the same thing with his with his own police, trying to say, "Look here, look at me." this is how it's done. So we've been putting up with this for at least 4 years or more with DeSantis. He should have no role in Border Patrol and things like that, but he didn't, you know, he did what he wanted to because he's sort of a petty dictator down here.
Andrew, are you with us?
I'm reporting for listening duty here. I'm learning and listening.
Well, we've had some interesting topics this week. What's the big topic you're running into out there? I mean, what's the Washington topic versus the are they going to not send out any tax returns now for the next couple of months or what? I mean, you know, what exactly shut down?
Well, it's a work in progress because one of the things that the Democrats in effect did with the shutdown procedure is they handed to the Trump administration the ability to say what's essential duty, or a more technical term, who has to show up and work. And even within a department, there can be different categories. So it's probably not a great time to get customer assistance from any department, including the IRS. But I have a feeling that they're going to keep the doors open to receive the money.
Oh, I'll bet there's somebody who'll take the checks. Yes.
Yes. Well, to go to your earlier question, one thing I did yesterday that was unusual but important was I attended the arraignment of former FBI Director Jim Comey across the river from D.C. in Alexandria, Virginia. And it was an unusually interesting proceeding. Normally, those are pretty routine, but given the scope of the case of an FBI director being handpicked by the President and Justice Department for prosecution on a pretty thin case,
What exactly are the charges?
Well, there's two counts. One is that he lied in congressional testimony, and two, that the lie represented obstruction of justice. So it's basically arising from one appearance, and it had to be rushed through within days of expiration of the statute of limitations. And I can amplify just a little bit. It had to do with the genesis of the FBI's investigation into whether Russia interfered with our elections. So this is a pretty big deal in a way, particularly since it involves a presidential election. But the last point I'll make on this intro here is that the defense attorney, Patrick Fitzgerald, right out of Chicago, he's got quite a record there. He said, look, we don't even know who the witnesses are that the government is relying on. And in this jurisdiction, and Wayne's an expert on this, they have a speedy trial procedures so that things don't linger. And in fact, according to their speedy trial procedures, the trial was supposed to be scheduled to start in the middle of December. And that's, it was delayed a start till January 5th. That's of this coming year. So we're talking about just a couple months. And so the defense attorney says, We don't even know who the government is relying on to say that Comey lied.
They're relying on Trump.
Well, no, you can't. To jump ahead a couple steps, the defense is probably going to subpoena him to testify, Trump. So what we have here is the ultimate case of Trump and his Justice Department trying to go after top officials and expose them, humiliate them, but things have a way of coming back to haunt. And so imagine if Fitzgerald puts Trump on the witness stand. So at any rate, that was quite a spectacle yesterday, and it will be continued at a rapid pace with briefs being required within days from both sides, or weeks. And the case may never go to trial because it seems like some of the major witnesses that ordinarily the prosecution would rely on will be defense witnesses for Comey. So.
Well, that's interesting.
Man. Yeah, I mean, the essence of the case is that at one point there started to be important news articles coming out about this Russia investigation or Russia interference. And the suspicion was that Comey had arranged as FBI director for information to be leaked. And he, in effect, denied that he had arranged anything like that to Congress. So that's what the case is about. And the two most likely people who did talk to the press have gone on record, one just a day ago, saying Comey did not authorize them to talk about it. So if the two people who did talk to the press are saying Comey didn't authorize it, what's the case of proving that he used...
Well, who are these guys? Were they FBI employees?
Well, one was his deputy, Andrew McCabe. And McCabe says, yes, I talked to the press, but as the number two official at the FBI, it's my job to talk to the press, sometimes without off the record. And he said, Comey never authorized me to talk about it. It's just part of my job. And I did talk to the press. But again, that's my job. He didn't authorize
me. What did he say he told the press?
Well, it's about the status of looking at Russian interference in the election.
Unbelievable.
And the other person was a Columbia law professor who has been widely assumed until the last couple days to have connived and worked with Comey to talk to the press. And so this looks like, oh, they're going to put the squeeze on this Columbia Law School professor, and he'll talk about how, with a wink and a nod, Comey orchestrated leaks to the press. And the professor, I believe his first name is Daniel Richmond, he says, no, Comey actually told me not to talk to the press, and I did it on my own. So if these are the two witnesses that the government's reliant on to put the former FBI director in prison for 5 years, how is this trial going to go when the grand jury in Alexandria refused to indict on one count, and only 14 of the 23 grand jurors were willing to sign the indictment on the other two counts?
Yeah, I would add there's another interesting facet to Comey. He was once the head of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. And when he was there, he launched prosecutions of members of the Russian mob, many of them of whom they live in Brooklyn. Some of them actually bought units in Trump Tower and other Trump properties in Manhattan. So this looks like it's a long running vendetta by Trump, and Trump lives and breathes vendettas. So this may be something he wants to go after Comey because he saw some of his quote unquote investors and some of his real estate ventures get successfully prosecuted. So just like any mob boss, Trump wants his revenge. And so I think, other than the fact, you know, there was the Comey thing with the Russia investigation, I think this probably goes back a lot longer. And Andy McCabe is another example, because Andy McCabe also worked out of the joint task force in New York, worked closely with the Southern District.
Wayne, wasn't the, I'm familiar with the Trump Tower and the place here in the casino, but there was the alleged connection with the Russians.
Yeah,
has mostly to do with some condominium building he built near the UN and all.
Yeah, that's a Trump building over near the UN.
But wasn't the economics? Yeah. His timing on it was just terrible, from what I understand. Nobody could buy a unit, and somehow or another, then a whole bunch of Russian guys bought units. Right? Isn't that where this all came from?
Yeah, and there was another unit that Ivanka and Jared Kushner were involved with, and it also involved Trump in the Soho building in the Soho area of Manhattan, and that involved some Russian.
But I mean, from the outside, all it was I mean, I'm not alleging anybody doing anything wrong here, but a bunch of several Russian people bought condominiums when nobody else kind of wanted them, and sort of saved his ass. Now, whether he gave them a discount and that's why they went in there or not, I'm not alleging anything untoward. I'm just saying the coincidence was that they bought those units kind of right when he needed them. Isn't that the coincidence?
Yeah, and you know, another major investor in Trump Tower real estate was the FIFA, the group that runs the World Cup, which was racked with a lot of corruption. Some people, I think, went to prison.
Oh yeah, that was
bribery.
That was a horrible talk about corruption, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So you know, today we see how Trump he's getting the World Cup here in the United States, a lot of this involved a lot of nefarious characters, and so when he complains that the FBI was wiretapping Trump Tower, there was good reason to wiretap Trump Tower. There was not only were these Russian oligarchs and other criminals in there, but also the FIFA group was in there.
Well, let me also add, for the listeners who may not be immersed in this, is there are several thorough studies of this in book and other form that illustrate we're not talking about rental of condominiums and on a modest scale, or Wayne was being I think diplomatic when he says nefarious characters here. Let me ramp it up the discussion. We're talking about huge amounts of money being laundered through real estate deals. And we're also talking, when it comes to nefarious characters, maybe that can be used, as Wayne did, to talk about people who are actually doing some of the actual transactions. But behind it is leaders of the Russian mafia who have they'd be at the Al Capone level, what we're talking about.
Andrew, I was kind of getting into it a little bit regarding what, and we got to go to break here in a second, but I'll set this one up and you can answer, because you like to chew on these for a while before you come out with a terrific answer. He was talking about the U.S. and, you know, he's talking about the education system, and you know, I buy a little of that, but not all that much of it. But you know, Lou always has some points that are good. I think that an awful lot of people, Vietnam era people, which you guys are as well, it's not that we're self-flagellants about our country and we wish it bad, but we develop a realization of how uneven things maybe always have been. We've always strived to make them more even, at least most people have, and somehow it's getting less even and almost by the day. Well, how is it, and Jimmy, who's on the board today, doing a good job as usual, knows an awful lot about mortgages. Well, I'll tell you what, if you want to close a mortgage now, you better have your sphincter open for them to inspect it, because if you have $20,000 in your bank account that your dad gave you, they want an affidavit from your dad that it's not a loan. If you're off by $100 at the closing, you can't pull a hundo out of your pocket and say we're even. It's got to be wired in. The amount of crap that the average American has to go through, the bureaucratic idiots in Washington over the last 25 years, it is stifling. Yet, on the other hand, we seem to have people from Russia buying a condo for $1 million or whatever the hell it is. I wonder how much people look back at that money and where it came from. I'm thinking not at all. And that's, I want your guys' opinion on that. And, you know, to me, that sucks. And that's why people are really having problems with what's going on here, I think. S&P futures up 2, NASDAQ futures down 6. It just keeps creeping. Every day you hear another story. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
We're back.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board, SP Futures. I'll say unchanged. NASDAQ futures down 8, so not much going on here. We had silver up, and we had gold kind of unchanged. But there is one thing here, and I noticed it's always nice when you have people on the show that are direct causes of stuff. Ferrari on track for worst trading day ever as guidance disappoints. People have canceled their orders for the electric Ferrari, and I'm looking down the list, and look who I find. Wayne and Andrew appeared to have canceled their Ferrari order. Ferrari in the dumper. Why'd you guys cancel your Ferraris?
I saw the sticker price. I said, if I buy that, there goes my lobster dinners for the next 15 years.
Well, not to mention, imagine the insurance rates on a Ferrari down in Florida.
Yeah. I'm having trouble paying my insurance rates on my Hyundai.
God. So what do you guys think of what I think people on just about every level, and that's why they're fighting with each other, are just about fed up. I mean, this plutocracy we're going to, and is, you know, everybody fighting, and look at the wasted energy fighting about your former FBI director. It's gone. He's not even if he wasn't perfect. What happened? I think he was pretty good. Even if he wasn't perfect, so what? Nobody is, and he's gone. I mean, what you think people are just generally pissed off or what?
Well, yeah, but here's the brilliance of what the situation is up to a point from Trump. He realizes people are pissed off, and he picks targets, and for his supporters, they feel very vindicated and justified that he's fighting for them. And it's only if people look deeper that they realize this enforcement against the enemies does not apply to him or any of his people.
Well, you think that going in, you know, that's
yes, there's pervasive regulation and enforcement and your mortgage example, but then you have Russian.
Well, that's what I'm saying. How exactly did that closing go? For the Russians, could you imagine being a real estate attorney on that one? How did it go?
It's working great. And to take a slogan that everybody should pay attention to, when people say the system is broken, well, it's working perfectly for a few insiders.
Oh yeah.
And in this case, going after Comey and the people looking after Russian crime here in the U.S. Undermines our ability to go after big-time foreign criminals. And one thing I got to clear up, I was setting up a kind of 1-2 punch, to use a boxing analogy, when I said Wayne was being very kind to these nefarious people. Well, Wayne is actually at the forefront of charting exactly who these people are, and he's made graphs that he can maybe expand on here that are so complicated that they're almost impossible to read, charting who these Russian mafia people are and which people in the Trump administration they have interactions with. And there's a couple books about this by people, Craig Unger and others, even Michael Cohen left Parnas. But maybe Wayne can amplify just a bit.
It sure does seem like there's a KGB agent behind all this, doesn't it?
Yeah. The thing about Trump is he and his close family have like 500 interlinked LLCs. Some of them are just paper entities. Most of them are paper entities, but it's clear that when you draw the links between these Trump LLCs, you also get into these members of the Russian Russian oligarchy who are investors in some of his businesses. Those 500 LLCs eventually blossom out to include about 5,000 dubious international entities, from LLCs, brass plate operations in the Cayman Islands and other tax avoidance areas.
Wayne, who keeps track of all this stuff? I mean, I know he's I have a feeling he's doing some of this stuff from the old lobby, but no way one person.
The FBI is supposed to do it, and when you systematically fire the people at the National Security Agency, FBI, and CIA.
And Tulsi Gabbard has gotten rid of the people who actually did this as part of the
No, my question was, who's running it from the Trump side?
oh, you know, this is, and look, it's, it, you can look at Donald Jr. and Eric, and they got their hands on a lot of stuff, and Kushner. It's the people that are working for them. They're corporate attorneys, business advisors, all kinds of other people. You know, the people who arrange for the bakshish payments to, you know, people in the Middle East and whatnot. So yeah, it's a network of people, and not all of whom are above board. I'd say most of them are not.
I mean,
above
it's
board.
That's a presidency under itself. It's like the
yep.
I mean, it's like, remember the part in The Godfather when Michael took over, and after two pages later, he goes, "I didn't believe we were involved in all this stuff. We got all these buildings in Manhattan. We got everything. Where'd all this come from?" I mean, I mean, it's a family
business, as Wayne was describing, with various operatives, and I watch these snippets from these Godfather movies all the time, because in part it describes the world we're living in now.
Yeah, but the Godfather wasn't a part-time president. I mean, it took all his time to and there weren't 600 units. I'm saying that's a real operation, for God's sake. I mean, I guess my question is, there has to be somebody at the top. I mean, how could it be? I mean, Trump's
the president.
Well, he's pretty, in a lot of ways, he's pretty talented business-wise, but how do you do both of those jobs, for God's sake?
Well, you also have other world leaders who play a part in this operation, including Putin, including Mohammed, I call him Mohammed Bone Salman, for what he did with Jamal Khashoggi.
Saudi
crown prince. You know, the guy over in the UAE, and a lot of other current and former world leaders are part and parcel of this sort of international. To me, it's a criminal syndicate, because
you think Ryan, you think it's much different than the thing Bush had going with all the oil people?
I wrote about that too. I wrote a book called Jaded Task about Bush and big oil, but that was more, it wasn't hard to find those links, especially, you know, with Cheney coming out of Halliburton, Kellogg, Brown and Root. A lot of those links were out there. Now, I argued that this shouldn't be allowed in government, because they were feathering their own nests. And, you know, with the Bush family, that goes back to Prescott and before World War II. He was involved with banking for the Nazis. I mean,
who cut the deal with the oil embargo, where they weren't going to let, they didn't really do anything, well, not so we could have, but where they made a deal with the Saudis that everything was okay as long as they invested some of the money here, and we would keep it off the balance sheet and wouldn't know it was theirs or something. Who cut that deal? Was that Nixon?
America's deal with the Saudis actually goes back to FDR.
Wow.
He made this concluded this special relationship with the founder of Saudi Arabia, the first Saudi king, Ibn Saud, and you know, Aramco, the Arabian American oil company, was a product of those negotiations. So, yeah, this has been this is a pox on every president since FDR, this relationship with the Saudis.
But it became a more specialized relationship through the Bushes more recently, where it was more explicitly Saudis support certain U.S. interests, and we provide security. And it's interesting, if you read some of the history here, that the average income for the Saudis, I think even in the 1950s, late 1950s, was about $70 a year. So it's fairly recent that the oil money has created our current image of them with just unlimited amounts of money. So it's been a process. But what I think we're suggesting here is it's now much more global, much harder to track, although Wayne did this chart, as he mentioned, with 5,000 entities. But who's got time to even try to decipher a chart with 5,000 entities? So we have to simplify it to have any kind of understanding.
Well, Andrew, it seems like it is, I don't know if it's as obvious to you guys, it probably is as it is to me, but when I talk to people that are, you know, totally on the opposite side of the political bent versus, you know, whatever, it's really the same argument. It's just a question of who you trust and where you come down. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want somebody in office who's never owned a hot dog stand because he knows nothing about business, and even though he's going to be doing tax, you know, tax laws and all kinds of other stuff. So you want somebody who's sort of well-rounded and is somewhat successful. You know, you could be in a business that you're not successful. Doesn't mean you're a dummy. You could be in a business just the wrong one. I mean, it can happen. But we're looking for kind of these people that have these skill sets. And we all know that even under, you know, Richard J. Daley in Chicago, if your flunky uncle needed a job, if you were willing to help out on the precinct on election day, and your uncle was at least ready to show up for work and handle a broom, which most people were in those days, you could get him a job. It was kind of no skin off anybody's ass, really, other than maybe somebody else could have got the job. But it was a crummy job, but it was a job for somebody, and you could live on that in those days. So there are always, in all human events, it seems to me, there's always going to be a little grease. You know, you got to wet somebody's beak. Nobody does nothing for nothing type of thing. Or what do you say in Chicago? Don't send me nobody that nobody sent, you know, type of thing. I mean, there's always going to be that in human relationships. The question is, what's the line? I mean, how do you want somebody in office, maybe like a Hoover, that was an international engineer and a brilliant man? You don't want a guy necessarily doing business out of the White House, lining his own. But who gets to decide, oh, no, he's our guy, it's okay, it's not a problem, or I can't stand the guy for him, and get him the hell out of there. I mean, we seem to be fighting over the line. I think most people, even on the show, that have different opinions of this, have the same moral background and really don't want people stealing on the rest of society. But what they're willing to allow their guy to steal in the hopes of his greater good is sort of what we're fighting about, I think.
Exactly. And that's why drawing the line, it should not be Putin. It should not be these Saudi and UAE kings. I mean, you know, who are having huge influence in the United States. Now, what complicates it, and I'm glad you kind of gave that preamble here, because I was looking at Jesse Jackson Jr. just announced yesterday that he's running for his old congressional seat after going to prison, and that he's some preliminary poll has him as the favorite to return. And I was thinking about that in the context of the show, because I thought, this can't be a good idea to have somebody who actually went to prison for defrauding the public be reelected to fill a Robin Kelly seat and have his brother in the adjoining congressional seat. This is going to, this doesn't look good at a time when Chicago is, most people or many people are saying, look, we don't need the Texas National Guard to come in here and round up Chicago people with these ICE raids. But it's ultimately up to the voters to say, well, we got to clean up our act here, and maybe we shouldn't elect a former prisoner just because he's connected with the Jackson family.
People vote for the name. People vote for the name. They voted for Trump because he was on TV, for God's sake.
Yeah, But ultimately, the voters have to decide, well, if I was still living in Chicago, no, we don't need the Texas National Guard running our city here. And we also don't need the Jesse Jackson family with two congressional seats, because this is, in effect, both sides are a problem, which doesn't solve a problem.
Well, the answer to Donald Trump is not Johnson, the mayor of the city. He could be worse. But just, you know, by the way, we just mentioned hits kind of close to home on Stocks and Jacks. Not before Wayne, he was on years ago, but before you guys were regulars, we had a lady on here that I happened to meet somehow or another. One of my buddies had, and Jimmy went as well. We went to a meet and greet for a lady named Karen Reeves, and it was in the Blue Island, go to the islands, Blue Island, Stony Island. It was in Blue Island. We go, a very, very blue collar crowd. The chow on the menu was tacos, and I meet this lady, and I tell you what, I am amazingly impressed. One of these people is just very bright, very attractive, and one of those that when you talk to her, her eyes lock on you, and it's like everybody else disappears. Very few people have that talent.
Yeah, Bill Clinton had that. I met Bill Clinton one time, and that's exactly how he operates.
It was Bobby Rush's district, so she was running. There were like nine people there was no Republicans. It was like nine people on the Democratic side, so she's running, and it was a real close race. And the other Jackson, the brother, gets a chunk of change from the Bitcoin guy that went to jail. And like in the last week or two, and he pulls ahead and wins. Okay, so then I think there was an orientation, and he like didn't even show up. Now, the brother was running again. Did he like never show up in Congress, or very rarely did? I mean, so Karen sends me this memo going, and so it begins. He's not even in there yet. He's already pulling the same stuff. She was a little bitter. And now the brother's running again. But because of the name, Jesse was always good for us, for our people. He never lined his own pockets with the Budweiser, distributorship for the kid or anything. Everybody forgets about all that. He's the name. And it's pretty scary. I mean, how many people elected Trump because they watched him fire people? They don't like the bureaucracy, and hope he does the same thing there. You're fired, which is what he's doing. I mean, there are a section of the population that votes for him just because of that, right?
Well, exactly, and the whole thing was kind of a phony deal. In fact, here's a little trivia point. The villain of the show, Omarosa, used to be my intern when I ran a trade association before she became famous on The Apprentice. So I watched that show and her rise. Actually, she's got some talents. But you think, okay, they call it reality TV, but it's fake. But they had a storyline that made it the number one TV show in America at a time that many of Trump's businesses were failures and being propped up, it seems, with Russian money.
Maybe because at a very young age I read The Sovereign State of ITT, and I kind of was aware of the mentality of the Harold Janine of the world back then. Nothing's changed. The only change was that you had Ling Temco Vought, LTV, you had Litton Industries. These were people that plutocrats. The rich people not only were successful in business, they were the smartest people on earth. They were the most moral. They should be running the world and not politicians. I mean, that was their view of life. And thankfully, those two places went under. I guess ITT sort of went under too, but because the accounting rules changed and you couldn't take goodwill to income or something, so they kind of all fell apart. The same mentality. I mean, do you think that Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or those people don't think that the world would be a better place if they were in charge? I'm sure they do.
I happen to have some slight connection with ITT, at least to observe. So let me jump in on that. We can remember those battles, those companies, but the regulatory environment is totally different now, because I think...
What regulatory environment?
Well, for example, ITT, one of their biggest problems that helped lead to exposés by Jack Anderson was they tried to acquire the Hartford Fire Insurance Company. And I was a reporter at the Hartford Courant during that time. And virtually every day I would stop into the chambers of the federal judge in Hartford who was ruling on that case. He was an old judge, Joseph Blumenfeld. And he's a guy who literally had a meal ticket, a yellow meal ticket, to go to the cafeteria across the street with his law clerks, where the cafeteria, the most expensive meal, was $2.30. And he was trying to decide whether this ITT, Hartford Fire Insurance Company, merger should go through, and he had the power to stop it. So if we fast forward to today, and he put them through some real tough times on that. But if we fast forward to today, where this week Musk just passed the threshold of $500 billion with a B in assets, and people like Larry Ellison at Oracle, they're buying up all the media, they've got all of our data through Doge, and so forth, and they top 2%, have something like half of the assets in the United States.
Just to put this in perspective, I'm not interrupting, so hold your thought.
Yeah.
Larry Ellison, in the one day that Oracle was up that much and they made that deal, made enough, I think, to buy every newspaper and maybe half the NFL football teams. He made that in one day.
Well, exactly. And so my old newspaper that used to have 230 reporters has about 15 now. And you can't possibly cover these people, whether it's Musk, Ellison, or Trump, or Trump's family, the way you could cover ITT back in the day when even the little congressman, there was a state insurance commissioner, Bill Cotter, who rejected the ITT deal. And these days, you get the crypto people donating to, like, the Jackson, as you said. Where is the countervailing force except at the ballot box?
And that's a... real quick, what is the story with this guy taking... I was reading some story. I had heard about him taking the bag of money. But then evidently Fox asked him, the Fox News reporter, what's her name, asked him if he took it, and he said, yeah, and she never asked why or what he's supposed to give up. She never followed...
Holman, he's the White House advisor. He's the border czar. And he took, supposedly on tape, a bag of $50,000. And the U.S. Attorney General, who Wayne has investigated for years, this Pam Bondi, she's a made-for-TV attorney general, blonde, good-looking, and she is totally unresponsive to any questions, even about why did you end the investigation of the guy that the FBI has on tape taking $50,000 in cash?
Well, she grew up in a town here, Temple Terrace, which is just east of Tampa, that was basically the headquarters for two guys, Santo Trafficante Sr. and Santo Trafficante Jr. And during Santo, the senior, he often entertained out-of-town guests that included a guy named Al Capone. Pam Bondi comes out of a mob-infested town here in Florida. So, you know, getting she said, only $50,000 in a paper bag. It could have been more than that.
I think Wayne's joking.
But why the Fox News reporter, evidently you can't, he admitted it, and she never followed it up. So what do you got to do for the 50 grand? Who'd you get it from? Those would be my first questions.
Well, he got it from, the FBI knew, was investigating, not him, but people who were contractors hoping to make money if Trump came back in, from Homeland Security, you know, these detention centers and whatnot, like Alligator, oh, yeah, Alcatraz here. And yeah, they said, well, let's see if he actually is involved in this sort of graft and corruption. And sure enough, he took the bag of cash. That I haven't heard about a politician taking bags of money since Spiro Agnew was vice president.
Well, remember Paul Powell, who died in the motel room, but he'd already taken the shoeboxes full of cash with him in the motel room. He took it with him wherever he went. Remember that? he was the Secretary of State here long ago. Yeah, he was Mr. Cash, and he. But the weird part was, when he got older, if he traveled, he'd put the 10 or 20 or however many there were shoeboxes full of cash in the car with him and have him in a motel room where he slept.
Hey, Chief, can I get Wayne to talk, not to ask a question myself, but it might be interesting.
We only got a couple of minutes, but fire away, yes.
Wayne talks about Comey's defense counsel, Patrick Fitzgerald, which is his Chicago connection in this regard.
What about him? I mean, I covered the his case against Blagojevich, and you know, he came. You know, his reputation is sort of like a Elliot Ness type prosecutor.
Well, he was the attorney general, or the attorney guy here, the prosecutor here, right?
Yeah, that's right.
U.S. attorney for Northern District Chicago.
But he came out of retirement now to represent Comey, so he's still apparently highly thought of within what's left of DOJ.
Well,
there's anything left.
You know, next week let's tee that one up. Jimmy wants to make a note, because being the attorney general, or what do you call it, the state's attorney here, U.S. attorney here, has been quite the job. Jim Thompson, he made a life out of it, putting Otto Kerner in jail. I don't even think was really guilty.
Yeah.
And look what it did for Jim. He became a huge mover and shaker at that was a law firm here, Sidley and Austin, whatever. And he became, and he was on the board of the board of trade. He became the head of the Metropolitan Sports Authority here. He had a massive career, based essentially on that one thing. And when Dan Webb did the same thing with Governor, what's his name, Ryan, right? He ended up being one of the big...
Fitzpatrick was also involved in the Ryan.
Yeah, those guys, all you have to do is put a politician here in jail, and the rest of your life is you've written your meal ticket forever. Right?
Right.
I mean, I'm surprised that... I don't think Jim Thompson ever tried a big-time case, you know, like Fitzgerald's doing with this one. Dan Webb's been a pretty successful in a lot of places, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, he's pretty well respected in the legal area, right? That he's not just, he just didn't have one case. He's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
He's still around.
I know you're teeing it up and we're out of time here, but on the other side, this is like the poison chalice for the Department of Justice current prosecutors, because if they're forced to bring a case, and they're up against a top defense attorney, and their witnesses are going to be testifying for the defense, and the trial is going to be within 2 months.
And the judge is a Biden appointee.
Oh, good. Well, guys, enjoy your weekend. We still got to get together one of these days and talk at you next week. I suspect by next week we'll still have something to talk about. What do you think?
Yeah, well, we're going to have to come out there and help you man the ramparts against this invasion from Texas.
Well, I figure we have the ICE people here. Now, to protect them, we need the Texas National Guard. And then we got to bring in regular Army. Of course, they're going to need a few tanks. They're going to run over a couple of people. You just see where this is going, you know. But
I laugh, but it's sad.
It is. Hey, I hope you two... characters are long silver. Silver's up like almost 4% today. It's up $1.62 4620. I never dreamed I'd see silver up here. Good Lord. Hope you guys are long it. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.